Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Healthy Gut Girl, Catalina Martone, and this is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. And I'm coming to you live from deep inside your small intestine, and I have some complaints to file because there's a whole lot of bacteria in here that are starving to death. And I promised everybody that I would talk about prebiotic fiber in the month of August. I want to do a whole month of just talking about the importance of prebiotics, not probiotics. And so all these beneficial bacteria that are in there and all these probiotic foods you're eating and these expensive probiotic supplements that you're taking and what's happening. They're getting down into your gut and they're starving to death because we aren't eating enough prebiotic fiber. And, you know, all these high-fat, high-protein diets, these paleos and these ketogenics, and as good as they can be for you, if you're foregoing large amounts of vegetable fiber, you are starving out your bacteria, which could explain all that bloating you're having on this new fancy diet that you're doing. So basically, this is a really important thing. And I have some friends at Freedom Foods that have asked me to do this 28-day reboot challenge because it's something that I feel like I don't get enough of either. And you know, I have that estrogen dominance support group on Facebook, and we talk about hormones all the time. And that's another really important function of prebiotic fiber, is to help clean out all of those conjugated estrogens from the liver out of the colon. You need that, or else your body recirculates that estrogen. And that's a bad, bad deal right there. So prebiotic fiber is good for a lot of things. And so I'm doing this 28-day reboot challenge with Freedom Foods, and I'm so excited. It started today, and you can read all about it in my blog that is entitled My Recent Aha Moment, and find out how to do the challenge, what it involves, and if it's right for you. I'm loving it already. I'm super excited because it takes care of my breakfast, which is my hardest meal of the day. So check it out. And today's special guest is someone who is an expert in this very subject. In fact, he is a gastroenterologist. His name is Dr. Will Bolsovitz, but we call him Dr. B. You can find him on Instagram as HappyGutMD. His Instagram is awesome. And he's so great. I absolutely adore this guy, and I had such a good time interviewing him, and you're going to enjoy him as well. He's a great speaker, and I hope we work again some more together. So please enjoy, and once again, take notes because this guy is full of wisdom. So here he is, Dr. B. All right, so here we are, and you're in Charleston, and I'm in Venice, California. Dr. B, how's it going? Good morning.
It's awesome. Thank you for having me on. It's such a pleasure to be on your show. I'm super psyched.
Oh, man. I'm super psyched because I really just get super excited when I have MDs on, and especially MDs who are crossing over into the holistic world. And I'm so curious about what, first of all, I didn't realize this until last night when I was really looking through your information and found out that one of your specialties is, am I saying this right? Is it hepatology?
Well, you know, that's a general part of my training. And so after I did my residency in internal medicine, which was at Northwestern, I went to the University of North Carolina, and there I did my GI training. But part of getting training in GI is also with liver diseases. So that was sort of comes with the territory. But the University of North Carolina, what was sort of special for me about going there is that I was at that time in my career very, very interested in being a researcher. And so my plan was actually to be a GI epidemiologist. So I was going to study sort of the origins of disease and population-based studies. And so the University of North Carolina has, clearly one of the top three schools of public health in the country. Them, Hopkins, and Harvard are the top three. And it's just, you know, every year they rotate who's number one. So they had this special program where I could go and, be trained clinically and also have this research training through the School of Public Health. And, you know, I kind of went down that pathway. I was on a grant through the National Institute of Health and published 20 papers. I had an amazing mentor there. His name is Nick Shaheen. But, you know, what was interesting for me, I mean, you just kind of never know where life is going to take you. And so I just missed taking care of patients. I was spending too much time in front of the computer writing grants and papers and not enough time face to face with people. And so I felt like I had to get back to that. And so that's sort of what I did.
Mm-hmm. So when did you kind of realize as a doctor that there was this other holistic side to it, or was your education including that? Was it inclusive with the nutritional world and the holistic side of things? Because you're that's what really drew me to your stuff, was all your blog is incredible. It's all about nutrition. And when did you incorporate that?
Well, so it's very disappointing to me that traditional Western medicine has not really embraced the nutritional aspect of things. You know, it's hard for me to understand, because we eat on average about 3 pounds of food a day, or 1,000 pounds of food a year, or in a normal human lifespan, 80,000 pounds of food.
Oh,
and yet somehow conventional, medicine has not really acknowledged that 80,000 pounds of food during a lifetime matters, which kind of blows my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So, during my training, to be honest with you, the last time that I had formal training in nutrition through the traditional pathway was 2 weeks of training during medical school. And I don't think I even showed up for those classes. Hmm. And I just kind of studied and did the test at the end, and I passed, and that's all I had to do. But after I entered clinical practice, I finished my training and I went into clinical practice, and I'm taking care of patients, and people ask me questions like, what should I eat? What should I eat to fix my irritable bowel syndrome? What should I eat when I have Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis? Mm. And, the thing about me is I really feel like I was born to be a physician. Like I just, it runs in my blood. I can't help it. I take it very personal. Each patient that I see, it's a relationship. It's not a time slot or a code or something like that, something crazy like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people ask me those questions, it's like, I need to give them a real answer. And so I would go home at night starting, probably around, honestly, about 2014. And I would go home at night and I would read and I would study and just sort of form my own thoughts. And I would dig into the science. And, from my perspective, I think that many people look at what I'm doing and say, well, you're crossing over into some other realm, the holistic realm or the natural realm or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't see it that way. The way that I see it is, this is what's best for my patients. And so I'm on a mission to do what's best for my patients. And if that leads me to places that are outside the box of conventional medicine, well, from my perspective, as long as the science is there, then that's what I'm going to do. And if I can back it up with science, that's what I want.
Wow. It's understandable if, let's say, a brain surgeon, isn't making the connection between, the 80,000 pounds of food. Thanks for that number, by the way. That's shocking. But like that a brain surgeon wouldn't maybe necessarily make that connection. But the fact that gastroenterologists are working with the digestive system and working with the gut, that to me is really shocking that they weren't incorporating nutrition, from the word go. But I guess it is what it is. So it's really exciting to come across someone like yourself, and it's just a beautiful thing.
We'll see what the future holds with regard to other GI doctors, to be honest with you, because, in addition to nutrition, there's this explosion of science with regard to the gut microbiome, which I know is something that you've covered in your show mm-hmm. on a number of occasions. And, things that just blow your mind, like that 10 years ago, we only knew of 200 species of bacteria that live in the body or on the body. And today, we can identify at least 10,000. And potentially, there's estimates that there may be as many as 35,000.
Mm.
And so there's this explosion of science that's occurring right now. And the pace is just like impossible for people to keep up with.
Yeah.
And it goes way beyond gastroenterology. And what I think is going to happen is you're going to see doctors 10 years from now start to do the things that I'm sort of talking about right now. And, I'm not saying that like I'm, way out ahead of these other doctors or I'm comparing myself to them. I think it's more that, to me, I'm going to the scientific sessions at these meetings. I went to Paris earlier this year to a microbiome conference. I spent a lot of time in Chicago at our big GI conference. And that's where you got to go if you want to hear about what this cutting edge science is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I say that all the time about, you know, I have an online program in my Healthy Gut Girl, which is called the Total Gut Makeover. And it's I really stress to everyone that I call it a live program because, you know, when I started teaching fermented foods and cultured foods 10 years ago, and, you know, then it was things were changing on a, or it seemed, you know, I don't have access to all the latest greatest, but I was noticing that what I did have access to was changing every few months. And now, you know, 10 years later, I literally am finding things every day where I say, oh, I've got to scratch that. And I've got to say this, like you just said about how many species of bacteria that they're, you know, discovering now. And so the program is updated constantly with this new information because that's how quickly it's changing and how quickly they're finding things out. And it's really cool. So your education taught, you know, you're learning about the gut, you're learning about disease in the gut and how to treat that. When did you realize that everything related to the body begins in the gut? Like when was that something you discovered in your research or did you start to notice that as a practitioner, as a doctor?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to say that there was this light bulb moment necessarily where all of a sudden I'm like, oh my gosh, everything mm-hmm. relates back to the gut. But I have had, you know, essentially as one of my catchphrases since I started my Instagram blog a year ago, that all health starts in the gut. And, you know, to me, there was just this natural progression of my understanding where I started on the nutritional side of things. And as I started to understand more about that, naturally, this led me to the world of the microbiome. And, you know, when you speak of fermentation, I mean, fermentation is a topic that I love talking about mm-hmm. because that's where nutrition and the microbiome meet right in the middle. And so as I started to understand more about the microbiome, you can't help but look at it and say, this is probably the single most important thing from a health perspective. And you can't separate nutrition from the microbiome. They're completely intertwined. Mm-hmm. But based upon everything that I've seen from a scientific perspective, that's the way that I feel is this is the single most important thing that you're going to do during your lifetime. And it's far more important than the genetics that you're born with, to be honest with you. I mean, you're not predetermined to have health conditions. You just have a predisposition, and it's a question of what you do that's going to determine whether or not you manifest that disease.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I want you to speak a little more about that. So basically, you know, you're saying that, you know, our genetics, that what we're predisposed to because your mother had breast cancer or your father has high cholesterol and his father did and his father did, it means that you have a propensity to that. You have a sort of a weak link towards that, but you have to trigger that in order to get it. Those triggers reside in the gut, would you say?
Yeah, I would say so for the most part. So, you know, just to elaborate on this topic a little bit.
Yes,
so,
please.
You know, the traditional teaching of genetics is Mendelian genetics. And so you talk about autosomal dominant, autosomal recessive. There's certain things that you can test for that you know whether or not someone's going to have that condition. For example, you can test for Down syndrome and you can predetermine whether or not someone is actually going to have Down syndrome. Or for example, my wife and I both have blue eyes. And so we know that our children are going to have some variation on blue eyes because it's not possible for them to have black eyes because they don't carry that gene. But the vast majority of genetics, you know, the types of things that we're seeing in our society today, whether it be heart disease or cancer or autoimmune disease, these are not predetermined things. These are predispositions. And if you take identical twins, there's going to be, in many cases, a certain degree of concordance. And so that concordance, meaning, you know, what percentage of the time do both twins manifest the disease, gives you an idea of how powerful that gene is relative to the environmental influence. So let me take celiac disease as an example. I think that celiac disease is absolutely fascinating. It's something that I take care of all the time. And so to explain, you know, celiac disease a little bit, just for the people that are listening at home, this is a autoimmune condition, which is a response to a particular part of our food, which is called gluten, which you can find in wheat or barley or rye. And so the body responds to the gluten and it basically attacks the intestinal system. And so celiac disease can cause a number of different symptoms. It can cause diarrhea or constipation or abdominal pain. But the thing about it is, regardless of the symptoms, regardless of whether you could tough it out and live with it, in fact, some people don't have symptoms from celiac disease. Regardless of that, what I fear as a physician is the possibility of intestinal cancer. And so there is a risk that if you continue to consume gluten, that can happen. So if you have celiac disease, you need to go completely gluten-free, like 100%. And so getting to the point of the genetics and this concept, which we describe as epigenetics, 30 to 40% of the population in the United States carries the gene for celiac disease.
Wow.
We are seeing a rising incidence. If you go and you look at, you know, any sort of chart of how many cases of celiac disease are we diagnosing, it's going up dramatically.
Hmm.
And we're now up to a place where 1% of Americans have this condition. And I don't know where it will stop. It could be, you know, in 10 years that 5% have this. And so what's interesting is the question, if 30 to 40% of us carry the gene, but 1% of us have the disease and that number is on the rise, well, what is the thing that determines that? And so this is something that I learned when I went to my microbiome conference in Paris. And by the way, if you ever have the opportunity to go to Paris and write it off, I strongly encourage that.
I'm going to keep that in mind. What time of year is that? Is that conference?
Yeah, it was an international microbiome conference, and there were all these rock stars of the microbiome there that I just
that.
You know, think that they're amazing.
When so is anyway, that? There was when is this, that conference though? When
I'm
is
sorry?
It, when is that conference?
It was in March.
Okay,
because yeah,
now I'm going
to
do
States
it
this year.
I'm going to get tickets.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. You can go online and you can see a lot of these sessions if you're interested. The name of the organization is called Gut Microbiota for Health. And you can go to their website. They got a great blog, and also you can watch a lot of these videos. So,
wow.
There
Thank
was
you.
This fascinating researcher mm-hmm. there, and her name is Elena Verdoux, and she's in Toronto at McMaster University. And so, what she has done through her studies is demonstrate that there are three conditions that need to be met in order to have celiac disease, and if you don't meet all three, then you will not manifest the disease. And so, number one. You need to have the genetics. And so if you don't have the genetics, it is literally impossible for you to have celiac disease, which is why that test, if you do the genetic test and it's negative, I can tell you right now, you don't need to do any further testing. You don't have it.
Which genetic tests? Any of them, like the 23andMe type of tests?
So it's an HLA test. And so it's HLA-DQ2 and HLA-DQ8. And so there's a blood test that can be done specifically to see if you have HLA-DQ2 or DQ8. And if you do not, then you know right now that you cannot have celiac disease. It's literally impossible.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't mean that you couldn't have gluten intolerance or a different manifestation of a gluten reaction, but you could not have celiac disease.
Okay.
And so number one, you need to have the genetics. But number two, you need to have exposure to gluten. Well, everyone in the United States has been exposed to gluten. I don't think there's anyone who has not. So that's pretty much taken care of for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And number three, what she found that is absolutely fascinating is changes in the bacteria in the gut. And so she found, and there's this term that we use called dysbiosis, which mm-hmm. basically means a negative alteration in gut bacteria. And that's a very broad term. And we have not really defined it for individual diseases yet. But dysbiosis in the setting of the genetics for celiac disease and exposure to gluten is what can lead to ultimately the manifestation of this disease, this condition.
And so could those changes be triggered by anything from stress to antibiotic usage to diet, or is it just we don't know yet what those changes can be, what those bacterial changes are, or is it like...
Well, so that's a great question. So first of all, we don't know exactly what we don't know exactly, you know, what change it is in the setting of celiac disease per se. We have this general term of dysbiosis, and what it generally means, not for all conditions, but for most conditions, it generally means a loss of diversity in the gut. And so, you know, I think about it like two generations ago, most people in the United States may have had 1,200 species in their gut. And right now in Africa, people have 1,500 or 1,600 species. But in the United States right now, we have between 300 and 1,000 species. And that number is defined by a number of things, by many different things. And so for example, the way that you're born can determine this, whether it's cesarean section or a traditional vaginal delivery, whether or not you're breastfed and for how long. Exposure to antibiotics. So, you know, one thing that I'm particularly interested in is the first 3 years of life. And I'm not a pediatric GI doctor. I just find this to be interesting, to be honest with you. But during the first 3 years of life, a child is born and they basically go from an almost sterile gut to, by the time they're 2.5 or 3 years old, they got the full 40 or 50 trillion bacteria that an adult-sized microbiome is. And so this is an absolutely critical period of time in terms of developing those, you know, that healthy, enriched gut garden is the way that I would like to describe it. So there's that, and there's the things that you inherit from your family. Part of that is genetic. Part of that is the gut microbiome of your mom or the microbiome of your dad. You know, each of us have our own, and it's a unique fingerprint. But if you're going to say who is it closest to, well, it's closest to the people that live around us. And then. There are the other environmental influences. So let me pull out the two that I think are the most important.
Okay.
I'm going to start with number two, which is antibiotic use. So take, for example, the antibiotic Cipro. So Cipro is often used to treat urinary tract infections. And in fact, many times it'll be prescribed for 7 to 14 days. Well, our studies show us that just 5 days of Cipro wipes out about 35% of gut bacteria.
Oh my God.
And so, you know, then the question becomes, okay, so when do you get it back? Well, it'll take 1 or 2 years to get even close to the number that you had from before. But the problem is this, you're never really going to get it back. Okay. Once you do that, you are forever changed. And here's the reason why. You wipe out 35% of the bacteria, and what's left are the 65% of the bacteria that are resistant to the antibiotic Cipro. And so those resistant bugs are now given a free-for-all to basically grow, expand, multiply, and take over. And so they're given a competitive advantage, and now those bugs are the ones that will be dominant, at least for the near term and going forward, unless you can, you know, do things to try to correct that. So just a couple of days of antibiotics can change everything.
And those bugs, that 60-65% or so, they're not necessarily pathogens, but they're just not necessarily the ones that we all, like, they could just be commensal bacteria, but some of them are probably beneficial bacteria. It's just that it's almost like the teacher left the room and now you've got this like haywire going on. You've got all this craziness going on of who's going to try to be alpha and take control. Is that a kind of a good analogy, or, cause how do you know the 65 is a bad thing? I mean,
right. So basically, the deal is that most bacteria in our gut are actually our friends. Mm-hmm. And one of the big things, when I give a lot of talks in the community, and one of the big points, in fact, many times it's my final point that I really try to hammer home, is that it's time for us to stop looking at bacteria as the enemy that we need to destroy. Mm-hmm. It's time for us to acknowledge that most bacteria are actually our friends and that they're there for us to have a good relationship with. And so when you take Cipro, I would compare that to bombing, you know, a city that ISIS has control over. So you can try to target the bad guys as much as you want, but there are going to be innocent bystanders that are taken out in the process. Mm-hmm. And so when you do that, you basically leave this, you know, blank canvas for anyone to move into. And so, yes, that 65%, some of them are going to be okay. But the problem is that it's not like you just targeted the bad guys so that the good guys can flourish. Mm-hmm. You really don't know what's going to happen other than the fact that what you have left behind are Cipro-resistant bugs.
Wow.
And so it creates problems. And so this is the reason why, you know, I'm not sure if you talked about this on your program, but Clostridium difficile.
Mm-hmm.
So this bacteria, Clostridium difficile, which causes diarrhea and colitis, and to be honest with you, it can be life-threatening.
Mm-hmm.
I've had patients who I've had to have their colon removed because of this bacteria. This is the reason why C. diff has exploded in the last 15 years. So if you go back to 2002, I was in medical school, and at that time, the only situation where we saw C. diff was generally an elderly woman in the hospital on antibiotics.
Hmm.
It was the only time you saw it. And specifically, it was this one antibiotic, clindamycin. So now we didn't really connect the dots at the time, but it turns out that clindamycin targets anaerobic bacteria. And when you use it, you're using it to treat bad bacteria. But here's the thing. The gut is made up of anaerobic bacteria. So you take this clindamycin and you wipe out your gut. And then all of a sudden, you have this sort of power vacuum where the bad guys can move into that space and take over and be dominant. And so C. diff starts to happen. So that's 2002. So here's what's interesting. I mean, it just blows my mind sometimes. In literally less than 10 years, I mean, by 2010, I was seeing patients who were in their 20s who had never been on antibiotics, had not been in the hospital, and they just live in the community, and they come down with C. diff. And so it's like, well, what the heck is going on there? Well, hindsight is 2020. So me looking through my glasses from 2017, I look back on that, and I'm like, it makes complete sense. Those people are dysbiotic. Those people lack the adequate healthy bacteria to prevent the C. diff infection from taking over. And so one of the main things that our bacteria do for us is they outcompete the bad guys. If you want to beat the bad guys, from my perspective, most of the time you don't want to actually try to destroy the bad guy. What you want to do is you want to empower the good guy. If you empower the good guy, then they're going to win. And so this is the reason why C. diff, we could not fix with antibiotics in the last couple of years. I mean, we have people who have been on 4 or 5 courses, months of antibiotics.
Wow.
So what did we do? We became desperate and we turned to fecal transplant. And so fecal transplant is, I mean, it sounds disgusting. And when I, like back in 2002, I heard they were doing this at the University of Iowa, and my friends and I, we were like in our 20s, and we're like, what the heck are they doing? It's disgusting. But the reality is, number one, it's not as gross as it sounds, but more importantly, this is the way that you can restore healthy gut bacteria. And when you do it, you take these people that have been on 4 or 5 courses of antibiotics, the C. diff keeps coming back, and you do this, and 2 or 3 days later, they are totally back to normal, and it does not come back. It is unbelievable.
That is unbelievable. Yeah, we did I had an episode called Repopulation,
nice.
Which was a woman who, same thing, had ulcerative colitis, and
uh-huh.
She was basically on death's door. She posts pictures in her blog and stuff. I mean, she looks, it's amazing, emaciated and so ill. And she went to London and she had the FMTs done there, and she had to do several for her to get well, and then came back here and actually is doing them here too, because it's kind of an ongoing treatment for her. And she got her life back. I mean, amazing story. And she shared with me some interesting information about a study that was done that I have here that's basically talking about fermented foods and probiotics, like over-the-counter probiotics or any probiotic, that they're effective when you're taking them, but they're noticing that there was no change in the microbiome variance when they tested this random controlled study of people, and they noticed that there was no, they weren't colonizing. These bacteria weren't colonizing. So the only way they really noticed that the microbiome was getting more diverse was through these FMTs. And maybe because it wasn't making it past the gut, because who knows, low or high stomach acid, who knows? Or maybe, I mean, I'm sure you can speak to all of this, but my husband and I were really kind of researching this and investigating it. And we thought, well, what if we started to administer things like coconut kefir water and the vegetable juice from the cultured vegetables and things like that, or adding like a probiotic to water, a high quality probiotic, and then administering it rectally, would it have the same impact as these FMTs? And so, you know, we haven't done enough studies, but we've done it on ourselves basically. And we have noticed some really interesting changes in, you know, bowel movements and bloating and how we feel after we eat. And it's remarkable. And in fact, he tends to get like a skin stuff. And he noticed that right away, that was one of the first things that changed in him, was he wasn't getting this like itchy eczema spots on him. And we thought, could it be? So what do you think about everything I just said?
All right. So these are all great topics. Mm-hmm. And so let me start off with commenting on the studies with probiotics and fermented foods. Mm-hmm. So the issue is this, is that if you go back again, 10 years ago, we knew of 200 species of bacteria, and now we know of 10,000 species. And the number of bacteria in the gut is 40 or 50 trillion. And so when we take these probiotics, like many of the probiotics that are available over the counter, if you read the label, it'll say 2 billion bacteria, 10 billion bacteria, 25 billion bacteria. Well, that sounds like an insane number, because if that were dollars, we would be very, very happy. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that you're talking about, you know, basically taking an entire pool and dropping a couple of drops of beer in there and then saying, oh, is the entire pool going to taste like beer now? Mm-hmm. You know, this is an incredibly complicated ecosystem. We're all individual. We're all different. We all have different species in there. And so it's making a lot of assumptions to take some combination of healthy bacteria that maybe in a study showed to be healthy, but it's making a big assumption that by putting that into a capsule, in whatever number you choose to, that's going to have an effect. That's a beneficial effect for your health. And so the issue that I have with most of the probiotics that are available over the counter right now is that they don't have a single study to demonstrate that they work. And to me, at the end of the day, you have to show me that it does something. And so that's where, when I use probiotics, which by the way, I use them every single day in my clinic, but when I use them, I reach for probiotics that have a clear-cut, demonstrated study, randomized controlled trial, where the patient gets either the probiotic or a sugar pill, and they don't know which one they're getting, and the researcher doesn't know which one they're giving until all at the end, they just throw it all together into a database and they analyze it. And if you can show me that it works under those circumstances, then I am 100% with you. But if you don't have that, then it's hard for me to really get behind your product. You're making a big assumption that it's going to make a difference in someone's gut microbiome. Mm. So I honestly believe this is my opinion when it comes to probiotics. I think that they're a little overhyped right now. Mm. And part of the reason why is because there are people that are making money, and so they're marketing them, and they're telling you how important this is. And anytime something gets marketed like crazy, people are going to buy into it to some degree. Mm-hmm. So I do think that in the future, we are going to know how to use bacteria through probiotics to manipulate the bacteria in our gut. I do think that's going to come, but I don't know when it's going to be. It might be 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. Now, there are probiotics that have demonstrated a benefit for irritable bowel syndrome or for ulcerative colitis at a very high dose. Mm-hmm. There are probiotics that have done that in randomized controlled trials. And so those are the probiotics that I tend to lean towards when I'm taking care of my patients. But to be honest with you, if I had the choice right now between probiotic or prebiotic, I would choose prebiotic. Mm. And so what I'm talking about is fiber,
right?
Plant fiber. The like sexy way of saying plant fiber is to call it a prebiotic, which basically means that you're feeding the bacteria in the gut. And so these bacteria that live inside of us, they need food too. And so never in human history has there been a society that consumes as little fiber as the United States of America in 2017.
Wow.
The average woman consumes about 18 grams of fiber per day. Now, the FDA says that you should shoot for 25 to 30 grams of fiber.
Which means we need twice as much as that.
That's exactly right. So I actually think that we should be shooting for 50, 65. And honestly, there is no upper limit to how far you go. The only rule from my perspective is you shouldn't make radical changes all at once, because anytime you change your diet radically, it just overwhelms the body. You got to ease into things. But there's cultures in Africa where people consume 150 grams of fiber per day. And guess what? They're the ones that have 1500 different species. And go over there and find a couple cases of IBS for me. You're not going to find it. Find Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis over there. You're not going to find it. Find these autoimmune diseases that are exploding. You're just not going to find it. They have their own problems, obviously.
Right.
But they don't have the types of conditions that are emerging in the United States because of our dysbiotic country.
What would you say the primary source of that plant-based fiber that they're consuming would be from?
In Africa?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're like chewing on roots. You know, their diet is not perfect. Don't get me wrong. They have a lack of access. So there's a lack of diversity in the foods that they have access to, but they eat what they have, and they may not have the ability to cook it. And so they chew on it. Now in the United States, you know, we cook everything, and we're used to having a 10-minute meal. You know, it's like, how quick can we get this food into our body and move on? And I think we're kind of missing the point. You know, like, food is intended to be enjoyed. And that is also one of the best social opportunities that we have during our day, is to sit down with another person, enjoy some food, and talk to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, so going back to this microbiome conference that I went to in Paris, it was actually eye-opening to me, because you cannot go to a Parisian cafe and get out of there in less than an hour. You just can't. You can literally go get coffee. It's going to take you an hour.
It's a good culture. I love that. You know, Italians are the same.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're used to cooking our food. So if you take a carrot and it's hard and you got to chew on it and mash on it a little bit, and you cook it to make it easier to consume, well, guess what? You just gave up. You gave up the fiber. That's what you lose when you take something, a vegetable, and you make it soft. So, you know, there's sort of a cultural issue there that we have in the way that we consume our food.
What's the difference between resistant starch and, you know, and fiber? So there's soluble fiber, non-soluble fiber, and non-soluble fiber is resistant starch. Is that right?
Right. So the insoluble fiber is something that really is just not digested, and it passes through the gut, and it basically pushes everything through with it. And so assuming that you're consuming an adequate amount of water to keep that fiber nice and moist and hydrated, the insoluble fiber is a great way to address constipation, because basically it's just a plug that's pushing everything through. But the insoluble fiber is not the part that's consumed by the bacteria in the gut. It's the soluble fiber. So the soluble fiber, to be more specific, is the prebiotic. And what happens is, the soluble fiber is the fuel source for the good guys. Now, you know, not every single bacteria eats fiber. There are bacteria that eat sugars. There are bacteria that eat fat, animal fat. So, you know, for example, why does Splenda make diabetes worse if Splenda has zero calories? Why? And the answer to that question is that when you consume Splenda, you actually are going to feed the bacteria in the gut that are good at processing sugar. And by upregulating those bacteria, when you go to eat another meal, whatever sugar is in that meal, those bacteria are chomping at the bit, ready to go, and they're going to process that sugar and absorb it, and it's going to make your diabetes out of control. And so whatever you choose to eat is going to be the ultimate determinant of what sort of bacteria you have in your gut. And so the soluble fiber, the prebiotic fiber, that feeds the good guys. So when I say I believe in prebiotics more than probiotics right now, the reason why is because whatever bacteria you have in your gut, whatever bacteria I have in my gut, we're different. But I can tell you right now that the good bacteria in your gut are going to consume this soluble fiber and use that as their fuel source and do good things with it. And the same is true for my gut. And so, you know, there's one additional point when it comes to the fiber, is that the fiber gets consumed and transformed into something called a short chain fatty acid. And if you go and you look at the health benefits of short chain fatty acids, it's going to blow your mind. And basically what you're going to say is, I need more of that.
Yeah.
And so that's where, you know, it's like really hard for patients to come to my clinic and not be told that they need to take a fiber supplement.
But you're not talking about Metamucil and things like that, right?
Well, actually the one that I like the most is Benefiber. And I'll tell you the reason why. Benefiber is, and by the way, I have no relationship to Benefiber on a formal basis. This is just what I believe in.
Okay.
It's 100% soluble fiber. It's just one ingredient. It's plant fiber. That's it. And so I like Benefiber. I actually take it myself, and I'm not vegan. I'm not truly a vegetarian. I do consume, fish and seafood occasionally, but I'm pretty darn close to a vegetarian. And despite that, I still take a fiber supplement every day. And it's because I believe in it that much. I wake up every morning and the first thing I do is I go downstairs and I get a big old glass of water, about 16 ounces.
Mm-hmm.
And I stir in a big old scoop of Benefiber. And that's how I start my day. I rehydrate, turn on the brain, turn on the kidneys, turn on the gut, feed my microbiome. And I get going from there. And so Benefiber is 100% soluble fiber, which is prebiotic fiber.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. This, you know, it seems like this sort of collective consciousness thing going on because, you know, I'm hearing you say this and I've just been talking to a company that makes a prebiotic that is that's called, I was just looking it up again. It's called, MIMO. It's, the oligosaccharides. Isothrive. Right. And it's the significance about this particular product is that it's actually coming from fermented bacteria process. What do you think about that?
Well, I believe wholeheartedly 100% in getting prebiotics from fermented food, like making sauerkraut or whatever it may be. I mean, generally that's going to be, you know, of course that's going to be a fermented plant.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe in that 100%. Now the issue with Isothrive, and you know, I haven't spent hours really digging into the science behind their stuff, but my understanding of Isothrive is that this is, they have isolated the molecule.
Mm-hmm.
So they've isolated the molecule, but it's not, as far as I understand, generated by producing sauerkraut and then, you know, like it's made through a chemical process.
It's a synthetic process that
it's a synthetic process, right? So from where I stand, from my position, what I choose to believe in is consuming foods that are natural, that I could grow in my backyard. Or I could raise in my backyard,
right?
And that we're, you know, that our forefathers 200 years ago were doing. And so now we can be smart about it. We can know which foods are good for us and try to, you know, actively pursue those foods. But I really, at the end of the day, I'm just not going to ever really be a full believer in something that's synthetically made to recreate natural products.
Right. I definitely understand that totally. So let's back up because unless I missed it, because I'm sitting here taking notes so quickly. So you said you were going to start with number two and you said antibiotics and Cipro. So what's number one and what's number three?
Oh, okay. All right. So,
first, remind us what we were talking about.
So what we're talking about here is what do you have control over in terms of gut health? You know, what are the things that you have the ability to take advantage of to have the healthiest gut microbiome possible? And from my perspective, I would argue complete health. You know, if you can take care of the gut, then you're going to take care of the rest of the body too.
Yes.
So there was an interesting study. So there's this guy at the University of California, San Diego, not too far from you, and he's doing something called the American Gut Project. And so you can go online and you can Google this, the American Gut Project. And you can actually participate in the American Gut Project. What he's doing is he's identifying what the microbiome of different people throughout the country looks like. And in addition to that, what are their lifestyle habits like? What, you know, tell me about how you eat or how much you exercise or how much you sleep. And so for $89, they'll send you a kit, and in that kit there will be a questionnaire, and also you send in a stool specimen, and the stool specimen is where basically they can extract your microbiome. So this guy's name is Rob Knight. And so Rob Knight at Digestive Disease Week in Chicago this year gave this talk, and this guy, Rob Knight, is absolutely brilliant. I mean, he is like probably in his mid to late 30s, and I look at him and I'm like, oh my gosh, unbelievable, man. So he is taking all of this data from across the entire country, and he has information about people's lifestyle choices. And what he did is he, and I don't think this has been published, but he shared this at our meeting that we had in May. What he did is basically he went in and statistically, like no bias, no like, what do I want this to be? Just statistically, what is the number one predictor of a healthy gut? And the answer is the diversity of plants that you consume. So basically what he found is it's not that you're a vegan or a vegetarian. If you're a vegan and you eat literally just kale all day long, sorry, you're just not going to be that healthy. You know what I mean?
Right.
But from his perspective, it was the diversity of plants. And that's because every single plant that you eat feeds the gut. It's going to feed a different population of bacteria that live in the gut.
Wow.
And you know, there's a lot of diets out there, and people can debate what they want about, you know, what is the right way to eat, what is the right diet. What I come back to when I make these choices is the science. And to me, what's exciting is we have the gut microbiome out there now to settle the score. What do the bacteria in our guts want? What do the healthy bacteria want? And here's the answer. The healthy bacteria in our gut are vegan. That's what it is. They're vegan.
But didn't you say that some bacteria eat animal fat?
Oh, there's definitely bacteria that eat animal fat. And are there some that are good bacteria that consume animal fat? I'm sure that there are. And, you know, again, there are these thousands of species that we're just learning about right now.
But the majority.
But the bacteria in general that you want that have shown a probiotic effect, and so when we say probiotic, we mean that, you know, it's not just bacteria in the gut, it's bacteria in the gut that has shown a benefit for health.
Okay.
And those bacteria are bacteria that consume plant fiber. And so this is where, you know, basically the science backs up the theory, which is that you need these prebiotics and these plants to have healthier gut bacteria. And Rob Knight is showing you statistically the diversity of plants that you consume is the number one predictor of a healthy gut. So I thought that was, you know, absolutely amazing science.
It is. You know what's kind of funny about it, though? It's kind of like all this incredible science, like, you know, researching all these people and this American Gut Project and stuff, only to discover that everything your mom ever told you, eat all the colors of the rainbow and, you know, of vegetables, is exactly what he's saying.
Yeah, no, I know. I totally agree. It's hilarious that we come full circle like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing is that, like when I give my talks in the community, I get an emotional response out of people. Mm-hmm. I get a lot of people that come up to me afterwards and they want to change the way they eat.
Yeah.
And you know, part of what I'm doing when I give these talks is I'm not just explaining what the gut microbiome is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm connecting the dots for people so that they understand, like, who doesn't look around right now and see that we have a cancer problem,
right,
or an obesity problem, or an autoimmune disease problem. Like, anyone can look around and you got friends, you got family members, you know, hopefully not you, but maybe even you. And it's like, so when people use the gut microbiome and this explosion of science to understand where these things come from,
mm-hmm,
that's really powerful. That's much more powerful, I think, than the message of just eat more plants, mom was always right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it definitely is, just substantiates it. Like, so for example, Donna Gates, who's the author of The Body Ecology Diet, so she always says, you know, 80-20. She's like, 80% of your plate should be plant-based. It should look like just a diverse amount of vegetables, from cultured vegetables to raw vegetables to steamed lightly vegetables to, I mean, she's all about that. And then 20% can be like a protein, animal protein, or just like a grain or something that's, you know, not so heavy on the on digestion, because she's all about foods that are easy to digest and grains that are easy to digest. And, you know, that kind of supports that, that idea as well.
Okay. So I come back to the Blue Zones. So the Blue Zones is a book, and it was really sort of a sociology experiment. It wasn't intended to be something that we're going to, you know, use to define like how the gut microbiome works or anything crazy like that. But, you know, basically they found these societies throughout the world, modern day, right now, where people are living to be 100 years old. And, you know, even more important than living to be 100 years old, people are living well. They are not, you know, stricken with comorbid illness for the last 30 or 40 years of their life, which is what I worry about in the United States. I think that we're going to be able to keep people alive. But the problem is that, you know, many of the people who are aging right now, they're going to live for 30 or 40 years with, you know, being on 5 to 10 or 15 medicines and in and out of the hospital and all of that. And so in these Blue Zones, what's interesting, so there's one in California, which is Loma Linda. And that is where the Seventh-day Adventists are. And then there's one in Japan, and there's one in Greece. And but there are these isolated pockets of people. And what they found is that actually there's a complete theme to the way that they eat. They all eat very, very similar.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. I just realized I read this. I know about this. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. And so, you know, if it were just the Blue Zones, you know, I would read it and I'd be like, oh, that's interesting. But when the Blue Zones and the way that they eat lines up with what the emerging science is showing us, then I go, whoa, that's powerful. And so here's what's interesting. So in the Blue Zones, they are, I mean, they're just eating the way that people ate like 200 years ago. And so people are eating 90 to 95% plant-based. But, you know, I would say, okay, we all need more plants, right? But it's also really important to identify what are the things that we need to be careful about. And so they have no processed foods in the Blue Zones. There is no processed foods in the Blue Zones. Their meat is clean. So they do consume meat. These are not all vegan societies. They do consume meat, but they do it in a different way. I mean, the United States, we're used to slapping down a 16-ounce T-bone. In the Blue Zones, what they do is they'll have meat 2, 3, 4 times a week. And when they do, it's for taste. Like, they're going to take small little cuts and they're going to savor that taste and enjoy it. But it might only be 2 to 4 ounces of meat as opposed to 16.
Right.
And so they have a different approach to it. So I'm not sitting here and saying that everyone needs to be a vegan. I'm not a vegan. But I think the way that I feel about it is that we need to radically change the way that we eat. But we need to do it one step at a time. And the goal needs to be maximum fresh fruits and vegetables. And it's okay if you want to consume meat, but make it clean meat. Make it clean meat, make it less frequently, moderate the portion size, and enjoy it. Take your time with it, you know, savor it. That's the way that I feel about it.
Right. Well said. I love that. I remembered because there's something about community as well in that. Wasn't there some common denominator, which was that all of these Blue Zones, there was some community about them? Like they, you know, they were, do you remember that part?
Yeah, there's a huge social component to it too.
Yeah.
And it kind of gets back to my earlier point about, you know, in the United States, we're kind of dropping the ball when it comes to mealtime. And so, you know, in the Blue Zones, that's a big part of their day is to actually sit down and have an elaborate, or, you know, not necessarily elaborate from a food perspective, but to have a meal, which is really a social event, and you're connecting with other people.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that I find to be very interesting when you think about it is like, what is the ultimate form of torture? The ultimate form of torture is isolation.
Yeah.
Right? To put someone in solitary confinement is like the worst thing you can do to a person. And it doesn't matter what their personality is like. And so I think, you know, to me, I know we're getting way off of like the gut microbiome here, but like to me, you know, taking the time to connect with other people, like in our households, it's important to us that we maintain an old-fashioned dinner time you know, where everyone sits down together and we say our prayers and we talk to each other about our day. That's a big part of what we do in our house.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I don't think it's a far stretch from them. I like to talk about the spiritual aspect of the microbiome. I don't know if it's necessarily spiritual, but it's a little esoteric with, you know, I kind of go off the rails with it, which is like, it's just a microcosm of us, you know, and like the planet is just a big, there's all these other little microbiomes on the planet. And then us as an individual, we have our own little microbiomes. And so when we're, you know, in community, that's a little microbiome. Like, I don't know. I go crazy with this stuff because I just think it's so beautiful and it's all relative. It all relates, you know, everything is connected. And it's, so I love that idea, but,
To be honest with you, I mean, when you talk about it like that, I am with you 100%. And I know that this is not what we came here to talk about today, but from a spiritual perspective, mm-hmm. like, you know, there was this theory, I think it was Nietzsche, who said, like, as science, you know, basically to paraphrase, as science becomes more advanced, that people have less of a need for God. But to be honest with you, when I study the human body or science, the more I learn, the more that I believe.
Yeah.
And so I think it's like this fascinating thing. It's such, the body is so beautiful and elaborate and intricate. And I really believe that we only know about 1% of what we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's so much more to it. You know, it might be way less than 1%, to be honest with you.
Yeah. So. You know, I love that. I mean, this is, I already know that I would love to have you back on because I feel like I want to go. First of all, I didn't even get to talk about the whole, and am I saying it right? Hepatology? Because isn't that the same? What's the study of snakes?
Oh,
is that herpetology?
Is that herpet? I'm not sure. It's not snakes. Like, to be honest with you.
I was reading your
seat. I am more terrified of snakes than anything in the world. And so, like, seriously, when I met my wife is from Charleston. And if you haven't been to Charleston, you got to come. And this is an amazing place. But When I first met my wife, I was kind of like, okay, am I going to be able to live in Charleston if there's snakes? Like, that was like actually a thought of mine. So
that's awesome. Yeah. Because when I was reading your CV, I was like, wait a minute, he's a gastroenterologist and he studies snakes. That's a crazy combo.
I study snakes like this. If there's a show on the Discovery Channel about poisonous snakes, I have to watch. Right. I have to watch because they terrify me. It's like watching a great scary movie. Watch because I just have to see. I guess it's like people watching Shark Week, honestly.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, I just have this obsession with the liver gallbladder thing. And I just feel like, you know, I'm a huge proponent of colonics and enemas of every kind. I'm a real fan of them and liver flushes and things like that. And I feel like we could do an entire episode on that because it's something that, unless you don't have a lot to say about it, unless you're just like, eh, I'm not a fan. But if you do have, then I think I need to invite you back as soon as possible because this is something I discuss at length with my clients and friends and lectures and everything.
Do we have a minute for me to comment on an FMT real quick?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yes, because I didn't get a chance to say that and I really want to say that real quick.
Mm-hmm.
So back to fecal transplant. Mm-hmm. Let me just say that, like, when I hear the story about your friend with the ulcerative colitis, and I've heard these stories a couple of times,
mm-hmm.
I think that this stuff is incredibly powerful. And I think it's going to change the way that we treat disease. Who would have thought that poop would be the cure for many of our modern health problems? Who would have thought that? That's crazy.
Right.
But the thing is, we need to be smart about how we go about this. And here's the reason why.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 1970s, we were giving people blood transfusions and we didn't know, but we were giving them hepatitis C. And there are a lot of people that ended up dying from hepatitis C because we did not even know that hepatitis C existed at that time back in the 1970s. And so the current state of affairs in the United States is this. We are allowed to give fecal transplant for patients that have C. diff infection, but there is no other way, there is no other situation where you can give a fecal transplant unless, at least administered by a doctor, unless you're part of a study. And there are currently more than 150 clinical trials that are registered with the National Institute of Health.
Mm-hmm.
So the science is coming. And I think that ulcerative colitis, to be totally honest with you, and you know, this is what I treat. I think that that's the next frontier, is how do we use FMT to treat ulcerative colitis? Mm-hmm. And I think it could do amazing things. But I would just caution everyone, as excited as I am about this, I really think this is going to be a game changer. As excited as I am, I just think at the same time, we need to be smart about this, because I think back to 1970s blood transfusions, and, right, you know, we thought we were doing the right thing, but we didn't know that hepatitis C existed. And how do you know that you're not doing something that you could harm someone with a fecal transplant too? So let's just be, you know, just to keep that in mind, I guess.
Right. And, you know, I don't know if what I was saying triggered this, but it triggered something in me, which is to say that a lot of people are actually, I mean, you can YouTube this stuff. People are yeah, YouTubing it and watching how to do it and taking their, you know, their sister's newborn baby's poop and making a slurry and doing enemas from it. And I definitely, I mean, but here's the problem. When people, as you know, are as sick as they can get with something like UC, they're so desperate, they don't care. And so I can't wait until the FDA approves this so that people are able to get this in a safe way and affordable way and covered by insurance if it's possible, rather than having to have all this money to go to England or get on YouTube and use your sister's kid's poop, you know? So I'm with you 100% on that, 100%. Yeah. It can't happen soon enough, is what I think. The science, yeah, and the approval.
Yeah, no, I'm excited. I think it's going to. I think that's going to be FMT. When you talk about sort of like probiotics, FMT is like a supercharged probiotic, and that to me is where we're going to see big changes in the next 5 to 10 years in how we treat disease using FMT. It's definitely coming,
and it's going. It's getting it reintroduced or introduced into the colon, where the dysbiosis is generally most prevalent, right? I mean,
That's exactly right. And there's a number of ways that you can administer, and there's even capsules now that are coming out. And if you go to my Instagram account, HappyGutMD, you can go back to a blog post from May, which was actually when I was at Digestive Disease Week in Chicago, and there's, that was one of the emerging studies, is about the capsules to give people a fecal transplant instead of doing it with a procedure. So,
okay. Well, that sounds clever too. So that, you know, that brings me back to that subject I was saying about experimenting with, you know, probiotic foods and implants. And, you know, I'm sure you've heard of people doing wheatgrass implants and coffee enemas and different types of things like that. And that can be a subject for another day if you'd like, or if you wanted to just comment briefly on that.
I guess what I would say is this. It's I lean on, when it comes to stuff, I don't know a ton about it. It's not something I use in my clinical practice. Mm-hmm. I lean on, you know, what is the science showing me? And so, you know, if there are studies that exist that demonstrate a health benefit and they're good, rigorous studies, then I'm all about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess it comes back to my philosophy and where we started with all of this, you know, of like, how did you end up in this place where, like, this is not what most doctors are doing? I'm very open-minded. And if there's a good study out there, then I'm all on board. But at the end of the day, for me, there needs to be good science behind it. And so, I just haven't seen that yet, but I think it's interesting stuff, and, you know, who knows?
I'm going to go, since we went a little bit off the rails earlier, and you're open-minded, I'm going to bring in my little conspiracy brain. Do you think that sometimes they don't want to fund studies that kind of promote people to take their health into their own hands because they're concerned about some obvious, rational, reasonable things to be concerned about, like people could hurt themselves, people could make themselves worse. But because, you know, then I wouldn't need to get put on a medication because all of a sudden I'm able to help myself with a probiotic implant, or I'm able to help myself with a coffee enema. I'm able to thwart having my gallbladder removed because the coffee enema was unbelievable for helping decongest the gallbladder. So, you know, like, what do you think about the possibility that there is some, you know, some energy towards keeping those remedies away from the general public?
Well, what I would say is this, is that there is tremendous inertia to evolve in our government. And that affects our health-related agencies, such as the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, or the National Institutes of Health, the NIH. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the other day, literally like 3, maybe 4 weeks ago, there was a report in the Wall Street Journal that the FDA decided that they are going to essentially permanently suspend a law that was supposed to go into effect next summer, which was going to require increased transparency in our food labels. So when I see them do that, mm-hmm. and I think about the mission of the FDA, which is to, you know, enhance the health of our country, I don't know if they're really serving that purpose. And I can't really, you know, if someone can explain to me why the FDA would do that and feel that that's promoting the health of our country to have less transparency on food labels, mm-hmm. I would love to hear it, because that to me makes absolutely no sense. And so I can't help but look at that and say, the lobbyists got in there, and the lobbyists got in there and were able to influence the policy of this organization that's supposed to be independent and serving the purpose of our health. Right. And so, you know, I just think about the fact that, you know, how much money do we spend on food? Like, if you just, you know, look at yourself, think about this for yourself. How much money do you spend on food?
And it's so everything.
So think about that, and then consider that in the United States, maybe not you personally, you know, or the people listening to this podcast, but the average person in the United States, 65% of their calories come from processed foods. Mm-mm-mm. So we are empowering this element of our food industry. And meanwhile, the farmers who are growing organic plants are poor. And so, you know, we're empowering the wrong side. And when I look at, you know, for example, that decision by the FDA, I say, well, I think I know what's happening behind the scenes there.
Yeah.
So I'm with you. I end up sounding like a conspiracy theorist. I think it's crazy, but
I know. It's not conspiracy anymore, though. It's just that seems to be the label that we're being given, because we're thinking, oh, wait a second. This sounds a little bit insidious. This sounds a little bit like sketchy. Something's not right about that. And so all of a sudden, I'm a conspiracy theorist because I feel or think that way. But then you look and you watch all the conflicts of interest and all the, you know, everyone's in bed with each other in regards to who worked for Monsanto, who's now, you know, running the FDA. It's just so incestuous and insidious, and it's hard to not start to think, wait a minute, why aren't they doing studies on coffee enemas? The empirical data that I have alone just in the last 12 years of my practice is unbelievable, just in my own life and then all my clients and then the people that I know and then those people and practitioners that I know and their clients. It's ridiculous. So I start to think, wait a second, something isn't right here. But anyway.
You know, look at the food pyramid, you know, look at the food pyramid. I mean, I can't look at the food pyramid and think that it makes sense, to be honest with you. And the other thing is, you know, so for example, like you can probably tell by reading my blog or just by listening to this podcast, like I love talking to my patients about nutrition. I love doing that. Mm-hmm. So explain to me, if nutrition is the single greatest predictor of health during your lifetime, and I think any intelligent physician, I could sit down with them in 5 minutes and make this argument, and I'm sure that they would be with me if they have an open mind. Mm-hmm. So if nutrition is the single greatest predictor of health during your lifetime, why is it that I cannot be compensated for the time that I take to talk to my patients about nutrition?
Right.
And, you know, you say, oh, well, you know, so I spend like, you know, 15 minutes talking nutrition with my patient, say, oh, well, that's uncompensated time. But, you know, it just gets more complicated than that, because I employ, you know, like we have 3 doctors and we employ about 25 people. And so that 15 minutes is like actively costing me money. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I try not to think about that too much, because then that would lead me to stop talking about nutrition. But I think for a lot of physicians, that's the impediment right there.
Mm-hmm. Major. That's a huge conversation in itself. My husband's a chiropractor and he doesn't take insurance, and this is his choice because, you know, he doesn't want to do you know, 5 minute crack them up, send them on their way sessions. He's very much interested in spending 20 to 40 minutes with each client and talking about nutrition and talking about, you know, everything that he's doing and that person's health and the role they play.
I commend them for that. That's great.
And it's tough, you know, it's a one man show for him and it's a lot of work because he can't really intern any other chiros, or he can, you know, because they aren't interested in that, because they come into work knowing these chiropractors graduate school and they know what's going to happen. They know they've got to get a job, you know, pumping out at every 5 minutes another client, or else they're not going to really do well. So it's interesting. It's kind of like a between a rock and a hard place with you guys. You know, it's like you're stuck in a way. I do have a handful of doctors. Now you're added to that group. Dr. David Miller in Agoura Hills, who has a concierge practice, and it's great. He really works well with that, and he's able to spend a lot of time with clients talking about nutrition, and it's fantastic. But
Yeah. I mean, there's ways that you could look at, you know, we're probably getting a little off topic, but there's ways that you could look to try to make it work. But the problem is it just ends up being so expensive that the only people that you're serving when you do that are the wealthy people. And so it's, you know, it's just hard. I wish there was a better way to do it.
I wanted to ask you briefly, you pretty much covered your diet, but so are you saying, gluten-free for everyone, or are you saying that people who have sensitivities and obviously celiac disease should avoid it? Or do you think gluten is a no-no for anybody?
Well, I don't feel strongly that gluten is a no-no for everybody. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I do feel that processed foods, which often contain gluten, should be, you know, pretty much at the top of the list of no-nos. Mm-hmm. I think that we all need to sort of take some time looking in the mirror and asking ourselves how much processed food we consume and do our best to try to minimize that. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, diet is not about being perfect. And if you feel like it's making you feel that way, then you need to kind of take a break and sort of refocus, because it's just not about being perfect. It's about knowing where you want to go and kind of gently taking your time walking in that direction. And so I really feel strongly that we should be trying to minimize our processed foods as much as possible. Mm-hmm. I feel strongly that when it comes to animal products, that we should be opting for organic animal products. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that the American way of having animal products with every single meal is really not in our best interest from a health perspective, based mm-hmm. upon what I know of the microbiome, and also, you know, supported by the Blue Zones. And so I think that, you know, we should be moderating our animal product consumption to a couple times per week. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, something else that is sort of overlooked many times, but I think it's important that we filter our water. And so, you know, you think about, for example, chlorine in the water. Chlorine, the invention of chlorine in the water, which was done to address the cholera epidemic, was an amazing thing. Mm-hmm. And added years to our life expectancy. But the issue is this: chlorine is a vehicle to transfer the water from the, you know, aquifer or whatever it may be, to our spout, to our home. But it should not be ingested. If chlorine destroys bacteria, then what happens when you swallow it down and introduce it to the 40 or 50 trillion friends that you got in your gut?
Right.
And so that's where I feel strongly that we should try to filter our water. And the best way to do that, if you can, and like, it's not cheap. I wish that it was. My wife and I have been saving up forever to try to get one of these things, but reverse osmosis. Reverse osmosis mm-hmm. is the best way to filter our water and make sure that it's clean, removing the chlorine, removing the fluoride. And then in addition to that, removing the things that we don't know if they're there or not there, but there's a darn good chance that they are, right. You know, things like pesticides or antibiotics or drugs, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And then adding something to the water, right, in order before you ingest it as a glass of water. Not if you're going to cook with it, but if you're going to drink reverse osmosis, it's recommended that you add like lemon juice or ionic minerals or something. Would you agree with that? Because it's devoid
of
anything.
Many of the reverse osmosis filters, and I think this is part of what, you know, makes them expensive, is just sort of the complexity of the system. Many of them do reintroduce those ions that you like, those negative ions that you need, mm-hmm. and so
it's not necessary.
So many times it's not necessary. Now, that being said, I mean, to squeeze lemon into your water, you know, to me, that's a great thing. Yeah. I completely support that. So.
Right. Okay, cool. Well, tell us how we can get a hold of you and reach you and.
Well, my main thing is right now is Instagram. And so a year ago, I started HappyGutMD. And you can go to that handle and follow me. And that's where I put my stuff out there. Mm-hmm. So I started this as a way to sort of connect with my patients, to connect with my community, and to have a way to share these things that you and I have been talking about for an hour now, mm-hmm. that it's just not possible for me to share all this during a 15-minute office visit. So I did that, and now here we are a year later, and I was written up recently by the Post and Courier, which is our big newspaper in Charleston. And, you know, I guess the bottom line is a lot of exciting things happening. I'm going to have a website that I'm in the process of developing, and that'll be coming later. But for right now, at least, that's the place to go, is HappyGutMD on Instagram.
Nice. Yeah, I can see you with your own little sort of show, you know, like having a daily or a weekly, you know, tip and talking the way you're talking. You're so well spoken. And that's a big, big, big deal. I've been doing my podcast for a few years now. And it's just, you know, it's one thing to be brilliant. It's one thing to be really good at what you do. It's an entirely separate thing to be able to deliver that information to the layman and be able to make it, I always like to say, digestible. But, and that's a special, special skill. And for you to be a medical doctor and have the education that you have and be able to relate all of that information in a usable way is awesome.
You know, I think that being a teacher kind of just runs through my blood to some degree.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's part of the reason why when I was at Northwestern doing my internal medicine residency, they asked me to be a chief resident, because a big part of that role was to teach. And so it's something I enjoy doing. I do it, you know, at work, I do it at home with my kids.
Yeah.
That's so good. I love it.
That's so good. I'm so grateful to have you. And I'd like to have you back so we can talk more about the snake studies that you've done, the liver, gallbladder stuff that you, the work you've done, and just inform us more on that stuff and gallbladder ectomies and all these different things. But that's a story for another day. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. No, I had a blast. I love it. Thanks for the opportunity.
I love Dr. B. Let's all say it together. I love Dr. B. He's so good, and he just really reinforces the whole concept about the prebiotic fiber and everything we've been talking about all the way back. I mean, it's everything I'm about, friends. It's the one thing I've been kind of missing out of my topic of conversation, has been enforcing the prebiotic subject, because it's been there. Donna Gates has a product. Dr. Marshall has a product. Galactin and Donna Gates, the Body Ecology, has EcoBloom. And so it's not like we don't talk about it, but we don't talk about how incredibly important it is. And I think it's going to be something that is revolutionary for helping us with all these, you know, probiotics we're taking, and to just keep our bacteria alive and thriving. And so just a reminder, if you want to read more about this reboot challenge I'm doing, this 28-day reboot challenge that includes really high fiber foods, go check out my blog at healthygutgirl.com. It's called My Recent Aha Moment. And also, if you could leave us a review for Stuff Your Doctor Should Know, it's super helpful. And follow me on Instagram at @healthygutgirl_ and Twitter, I'm @healthygutgirl. And come on to Facebook, I'm Healthy Gut Girl. And I also have my estrogen dominance support group there that you can look up and ask to be a member. And my total gut makeover, yay, it's doing so well. And I'm just enjoying being able to get on the forum and help people out. And it's just really, really fun. And that coupon is still available if you're interested. So go to healthygutgirl.com and click on Total Gut Makeover. Bye. Yay.